borrowed a Bible from the Vicar's study because I want to refer to it a time or two today. So what I want to do in this lecture is to try to convince you that if you really want to read this Bible literally, it is because you have a profound ignorance about this book. If you really want to distort the Bible and the purpose for which the gospel writers wrote, you will view it literally. And we're in a strange position in the church where the church is still defending a literal interpretation of the Bible, and biblical scholars are regarded as people attacking the true faith. That's about 180 degrees wrong. I'll come back to the Bible in just a moment. In the first lecture last evening, we tried to look at Jesus the man, the human figure underneath the mythology that has been laid upon him. In the second presentation, I want to look at the Jewish Jesus that lies beneath the Christian Christ. A Jewish Jesus who's generally been lost in our world. Let me paint him with Jewish colors. His name was Yeshua. In Aramaic, it would be written as Joshua. It becomes Jesus only in English. The only Bible this Jesus, this Yeshua, ever knew was what you and I call the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures. The only hymnal this Jewish Jesus ever used was what we call the Book of Psalms. Try to envision him looking Jewish. The typical Jewish male in the first century was between 5'5" and 5'7" tall. I don't know how that translates into meters, but you can figure that out. He was not a big man. He would have weighed somewhere around 115 to 130 pounds. He would have had olive skin. He was an Asian. Sometimes the Western Church forgets that. I said once that Jesus probably looked more like Yasser Arafat than those medieval portraits that we see of him, but that was not terribly popular with my audience. I grew up in my Sunday school quite sure that Judas was a Jew, and Annas and Caiaphas were Jews, and the Pharisees and the Sadducees were Jews. But when I looked at a picture of Jesus, I thought he was a Swede. He had blonde hair and blue eyes and fair skin. That's a very great distortion of the Jewish Jesus. I would like to argue that the Jewish Jesus, who is the basis of the Christian church, but unfortunately most Christians have forgotten his Jewish heritage. So I want to spend some time today raising your consciousness to how deeply Jewish Jesus was, particularly the Jesus of the Synoptic Gospels, Mark, Matthew, and Luke. And in the process of doing that, I hope to demonstrate that those who read the New Testament literally cannot possibly understand it. They are guilty of distorting the gospel in a primary way. And it's time that the other Christians of this world stand up and refuse to allow our scriptures to be so badly distorted by those who think they are doing God a service. The whole purpose of the Gospels was to interpret the Jesus experience. And in the interpretation, I submit that Jesus was shaped by Hebrew stories, shaped by Hebrew liturgy, and shaped by the entire Jewish experience. Let me begin by saying, if you would take a concordance and look up the word synagogue, and trace the number of times in Mark, Matthew, and Luke that Jesus is in a synagogue, you would probably be surprised. He frequented the synagogue. Those references are so plentiful in each of the Synoptic Gospels that one of them goes so far as to say Jesus went into the synagogue as was his custom. It is also clear, if you look at the book of Acts, and if you look at the epistles of Paul, that the disciples of Jesus, after his earthly life, also frequented the synagogue. And when I write about Jesus for the non-religious, I tried to demonstrate that the only place where the oral tradition could have lived and traveled for the 40 years between Jesus' birth, Jesus' death, and the writing of the first gospel, the only place that the oral tradition could have lived and been passed on was not in the marketplace, not in generations talking to their children, not in friends talking over the back wall. It had to become only in the synagogue. And the chief evidence for that is by the time the Gospels were written, the scriptures of the Jews had been wrapped around Jesus of Nazareth in a very significant way. That's present in every verse of Mark, Matthew, and Luke, and that could only have happened in the synagogue. Let me tease it out for just a moment. Mark opens his gospel this way, and this is the first gospel. We haven't any gospel before Mark. And Mark opens his gospel by saying, "The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, as it is written in the prophet Isaiah." It's an interesting place to start the story, in the prophet Isaiah. And actually, he starts in the prophet Malachi. He doesn't quote Isaiah until he quotes Malachi. So before you get into the first verse of the Synoptic Gospels, Malachi and Isaiah, two of the prophets, have been quoted as background to the Jesus story. Now, when I was a child growing up in my evangelical fundamentalist church, I was told that all of these prophets simply predicted the things that Jesus would do, and that Jesus, by living out their predictions, proved his divinity. What I need for you to begin to embrace is that the Jesus story developed in the synagogue with the scriptures of the Old Testament opened, and the story of Jesus was told in terms of those scriptures. It was not predictive. It was reading back and using those stories to illumine Jesus of Nazareth. So as soon as Mark introduces his story with references to Malachi and Isaiah, then he immediately moves to introduce John the Baptist. But if you were Jewish, you would understand what he's doing. For he clothes John the Baptist with the clothes of Elijah. Every Jew knew what Elijah's costume was. He wore camel's hair and a leather belt around his waist. And that's immediately what is put on to John the Baptist. The Jews would have recognized this man is being portrayed not as John the Baptist, but as Elijah. He then gives John the Baptist the diet of Elijah. Every Jew would have known that diet. He ate locusts and wild honey. That might not be appealing to you or me, but that's about all they had out in the wilderness. And then he locates John the Baptist in Elijah's wilderness. Every Jew would recognize when they read this opening chapter of Mark's gospel that Elijah the prophet was now thought to be present in the life of John the Baptist, who would prepare the way for the Jewish Jesus. When you go to Matthew, we find that he also opens his gospel with a reference, not just a reference, with a total litany of Jewish activities. Matthew opens his gospel with 17 verses. They are the most boring verses in the entire Bible. That's why I'm going to preach on them tomorrow morning here in this church. I hope you'll read them. The 17 first verses, it's the who begat whom verses. Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob begat Judah and Joseph and all his brethren. And you go on down through the kings, and David begat Solomon, and Solomon begat Rehoboam, and all the way through the kings. If you were Jewish, you would resonate with all of that. Matthew opens his gospel by recounting Jewish history in three epochs: the Abraham to David first generation of the Jewish epoch, David to the exile, the second generation, the exile to Joseph, the third generation, all designed to prepare the way for the Jewish Jesus to be understood. It's rather fascinating. It's not literal. Matthew actually leaves out 10 or 12 kings in the royal line because he wants to put it into a symmetry. Matthew also does some rather interesting things. He puts four women into the genealogy. That's unheard of in that patriarchal era. But they are there. But the fascinating thing about these women is that they're all tainted by sexual sins. What do you suppose Matthew's trying to communicate? He says Tamar is in the line that produced Jesus. If you go back and read Tamar's story in the 38th chapter of Genesis, you'll discover that she had an incestuous relationship with her father-in-law and bore twins. And one of those twins became the line through which Jesus was produced. And then he tells the story of Rahab. You can find her story in Joshua chapters 2 and 6. She was known as Rahab the prostitute. She lived in the red light district of Jericho. She assisted Joshua's spies when they came into the land. She let them down from the roof of her house. She was promised that when the Jewish army moved in, she would be spared, and she must have been spared, for she married a Jewish man. And Rahab the prostitute becomes a life through which the line that is to produce Jesus develops. And then he tells the story of Ruth. You can read her story in the book by her name, but you better read it all, because people know just a little bit about Ruth. They don't know about the third chapter where she gets Boaz well drunk with wine and he goes to sleep sort of unconscious, and she puts a blanket over him and she crawls under the blanket with him, and he wakes up the next morning. There's this woman in bed with him, and he didn't quite know anything that he'd done the night before, so he's forced to marry her. It's a rather interesting story. And then the last woman is Bathsheba. And she's the adulteress. So Matthew introduces the story of Jesus by giving the line that goes through all Jewish history and says, and oh, by the way, there was an incestuous relationship and a prostitute and a seductress and an adulteress in that line. And then he tells the virgin birth story. That's how he introduces it. And he introduces it with this line. Before Mary and Joseph, who were engaged, came together, Mary was found to be with child, and Joseph decided to put her away. It's an interesting story. I wonder why people never read those first 17 verses as a preamble to the virgin birth story being introduced into the Christian tradition. That's a very interesting way to introduce what might be the scandal of the crib. But then what Matthew does is that he grounds the virgin birth story in the book of Isaiah. It's an interesting thing to do. And then he introduces the flight of Mary, Joseph, and the baby Jesus into Egypt, because he wants to tell the story of God calling God's son out of Egypt in the same way that God called God's people out of Egypt at the time of Moses. And then he goes on to tell about how King Herod slaughters all the innocent children in Bethlehem. And he grounds that story in the book of the prophet Jeremiah. And then he tells the story of the wise men. And Matthew got the wise men from Isaiah 60. Maybe you ought to read Isaiah 60 sometime so you'll see the connection. Isaiah 60 says, kings shall come to the brightness of God's rising. They will come on camels. They will come from Sheba. And they will bring gold and frankincense. Doesn't that sound just a little bit familiar? But you all have been raised in Anglican and Presbyterian Sunday school, so you say, where's the myrrh? But Isaiah says they will come from Sheba. And the Jewish mind would say, Sheba? Wasn't there another story in our tradition about a royal visitor coming to pay homage to a different king of the Jews? They'd go back and they'd find the Queen of Sheba story coming to visit King Solomon. Guess what she brought? Truckloads of spices. The only spice they knew was myrrh, a sweet-smelling resin off a bush. It was used by Jews as a sort of deodorant. They put it in their clothes because they didn't bathe frequently. And they discovered that when a Jewish person died, the Jews didn't know anything about embalming. That was an Egyptian trick. When the Jewish person died, the battle was between the odors of death and the sweet-smelling myrrh. So they would wrap myrrh around the body and wrap the body and bury the body very quickly. And so myrrh became a symbol for death. And gold was a symbol for being a king. And frankincense was a symbol of the incense going up to God. So this story is a beautifully crafted story based upon Isaiah 60 about kings coming to the brightness of God's rising and bringing gifts that indicate that this life is going to be kingly, divine, and it's going to be manifested through dying. You couldn't introduce the Jesus story any better than that. But that doesn't mean that there actually were wise men who got on camels and followed a rather slow-moving star through all of the world until they came to the place where Herod lived, and then to the place where Jesus lived. Over and over again, Matthew is grounding his story in the Jewish scriptures. And when you get to Luke, you find the same thing happening. Luke opens his narrative with the story of the birth of John the Baptist. We mentioned it last night. John the Baptist was born to postmenopausal parents. Every Jew would have recognized that story. An angel appears to Zechariah to tell him he's going to have a baby, despite the fact that he and his wife are elderly. But go back and read the Abraham-Sarah story in the book of Genesis. An angel appears and tells them that they're going to have a baby, despite their well-advanced years. It's going to be a very special life. Isaac, their son, was called the child of promise. The story of the fetus of John the Baptist leaping in the womb of his mother Elizabeth in order to salute the fetus of Jesus, who was still in the womb of his mother Mary, that is clearly not history. It's an interpretive story, but where does it come from? Go back and read the book of Genesis. The wife of Isaac, a woman named Rebekah, is pregnant with twins. The twins leap in her womb, and she goes to consult an oracle about what this leaping means. And the message was that the older boy, Esau, is going to wind up serving the younger boy, Jacob. Luke simply makes them not twins, but kinfolk. But the story and the message is the same. John the Baptist leaps in Elizabeth's womb, and the message is that the older John the Baptist is going to wind up being subservient to the younger Jesus of Nazareth. And then there's the story of the shepherds. The shepherds are only in Luke's narrative. They populate Bethlehem, and they're reminiscent of the major reason that the birth of Jesus was moved from Nazareth to Bethlehem. Bethlehem was the home of David. David was the shepherd king. David was the shepherd boy who had slain the giant Goliath and who was called from his work as herding the shepherds to be the king. And Jesus was being projected as the heir to the throne of King David. Luke says that the baby Jesus upon his birth was wrapped in swaddling clothes and placed in a manger. Those are the two clues. The swaddling clothes are mentioned three times. The manger is mentioned twice. They were clearly important symbols. But where do they come from? The book of the Wisdom of Solomon has Israel's most opulent king say, "When I was born, I was carefully swaddled," because that's the only way a king can come to his people. The Jewish readers of Luke's gospel would have understood that. In the book of Isaiah, the first chapter, the prophet complains, "Well, even a donkey knows his master's manger, his feeding trough, his crib. But my people do not know me." And so Luke decides to put the quintessential Jewish figure into the manger of the Lord so that from the beginning of his life, one would say that this Jew at least knows whose manger, whose crib he's in, Those are symbols that Luke uses that Matthew never bothers with. And then there's the story of the boy Jesus being taken up at age 12 to Jerusalem in a kind of bar mitzvah experience with his mother and father. And where does that story come from? Go back and read the story of Samuel, who's dedicated to the temple and who goes up when he reaches the age of puberty to be dedicated in the temple and to become the servant of the old priest Eli. The Samuel story is also wrapped around Jesus over and over again. When Mary sings the Magnificat, when she is said to be soon to be the mother of the Christ child, you'll find the Magnificat is adapted from Hannah's song when she learned that in her old age, she too, or at least in her barren state, she too would produce a son. And so Hannah sings a song that the Magnificat is copied from. Again, every Jew who would be reading these Gospels, and the first audience for the Gospels were Jewish people, they would know what these symbols were about. It would not have occurred to them to literalize these symbols. That would have missed the meaning completely. They knew these Gospel writers were writing interpretive narratives, not biographies, not stories of things that really happened. Unfortunately, however, the time came in Christian history, about 100 years after the life of Jesus had come to an end, when there were no more Jews in the Christian movement. The Christian movement had turned Gentile. It had moved out of the Jewish world into the Mediterranean world, into the Neoplatonic Greek-thinking world. And increasingly, no Christians knew the Jewish background to their own scriptures. And from about 150 until about, well, at least maybe 50 years ago, the only people that interpreted the Gospels were Gentiles who didn't know anything about their Jewish heritage. The only people who wrote commentaries on the Gospels were Gentiles, and they were not only ignorant of the Jewish background, they were absolutely prejudiced against it. Antisemitism was deep in the heart of the Christian story. It begins with a man named Marcion, about 140, who wants to rip the Old Testaments out of all the Christian Bibles. He wants to take every reference to the God of the Jews out of the gospel story. And though the church resisted Marcion officially, unofficially, antisemitism became absolutely a part of the Christian faith from that day until relatively recently. And so you cannot read the Gospels without knowing the Jewish background. And if you read them as if they're literal stories, you totally misunderstand what the writers of the Gospels were meaning to convey. Let me take, to illustrate this point even further, let me take the later two synoptic Gospels, Matthew and Luke, and develop this idea more thoroughly. I mentioned last night that Matthew copied Luke, copied Mark. About 90% of Mark can be reproduced from quotations of Mark in Matthew's gospel. And Matthew expanded Mark in a very Jewish direction. Luke also copied Mark. About 50% of Mark can be extracted from Luke's gospel. And he interpreted Jesus in a much more dispersed Jewish, even Gentile proselyte kind of direction. And so it's interesting to watch that the Jewish Matthew adopts Moses as the image around which he's going to build his Jesus story. And the more Gentile-oriented Luke adopts Elijah as the figure around which he's going to develop his story of Jesus. Remember in the transfiguration narrative that Matthew, Mark, and Luke all record, Jesus goes up on a mountain, and Moses, who's been dead for 1,250 years, and Elijah, who's been dead for about 850 years, are both said to appear on top of that mountain with him. And all three become translucent. They become whiter than any Clorox or human bleach could ever have gotten them. They glow with the light of God. And the disciples, want to make these three pillars of the Hebrew tradition equal. Let's build three tabernacles, one for you, Jesus, one for Moses, one for Elijah. That was the highest praise that a Jewish person could think of, to put Jesus in the same category with the lawgiver and with the beginning of the prophetic movement. The Jewish tradition began to hang on the law and the prophets. But the voice comes out of the cloud in this interpretive story and says, no, Moses and Elijah are going to find their fulfillment in this Jesus. It's not three equal ones. And that's how the gospel writers develop their interpretive process. Moses, the giver of the law, directed his attention inward to the intra-Jewish life. Elijah, the prophet, directed the attention outward. The prophetic movement always called the Jewish people beyond their boundaries into the wider world. So Matthew becomes the hero, or Moses becomes the hero for Matthew, and Elijah becomes the hero for Luke. And if you don't understand those underlying themes, neither Matthew nor Luke is going to make much sense. Let me lift Moses out of Matthew's story. Matthew uses Moses as his key to interpreting Jesus. And he lets you know up front what he's going to do, because he inserts a Moses story into the birth narrative. When Moses was born, a wicked king went down to Egypt and ordered the destruction of all the Jewish boy babies, trying to get rid of the promised deliverer. So Matthew tells that story about Jesus. The wicked king has become Herod. Bethlehem has become the new Egypt. Herod goes down to Bethlehem to destroy all the Jewish boy babies so that he can get rid of this pretender to his throne. Every Jew would have recognized that that was not history. That's a Moses interpretive story being wrapped around Jesus of Nazareth. And if you aren't satisfied at that point, in order to escape Herod, they have to fly to Egypt, says Matthew. No other gospel has any story about Jesus going down to Egypt. It wasn't exactly a close journey. But Matthew has him go down to Egypt. Why? Because he wants to complete the Moses cycle. He quotes Hosea, out of Egypt have I called my son. So Jesus has got to be called out of Egypt as Moses and as the people of Israel were called out of Egypt. And then Matthew comes to the birth narrative, the baptismal narrative. And he tells that story as if it's a Red Sea story of Moses. Now, for you to understand that, we need to go into the biblical narrative just a bit. Most people are familiar with the Red Sea story, not because they read the Bible, but because they've seen Cecil B. DeMille's dreadful movie called The Ten Commandments. So you have a very real mental image. That movie sets back the cause of biblical scholarship 50 years every time it's played. And in my country, they play it on national TV every Lent. So we keep working against this incredible mentality. But in any event, the story in the Hebrew Scriptures was that God had power over water. And in the Moses story, God demonstrated that power by splitting the Red Sea so the children of Israel could walk through on dry land. But that's not the only body of water that gets split in the Jewish tradition. They keep repeating that story. Joshua splits this flooded Jordan River so he and the people of Israel can walk through on dry land. Elijah splits the Jordan River so that he can go across on dry land. Elisha splits the Jordan River so that he can go across on dry land. You get the impression that God didn't have a lot to do in the ancient world except split every body of water that impeded every Jewish traveler. But that's not literal. That's the way the Jews told their story. What they were trying to say is the same God we met present in the life of Moses, we also met present in the life of Joshua. We met present in the life of Elijah. We met present in the life of Elisha. Now fast forward for 800 years, and you come to the life of Jesus of Nazareth. And what the author is trying to say is, we believe we've met a God presence in Jesus is even greater than the God presence in the greatest of our heroes in the past. But how is he going to say that? That's how you read the baptismal story. Matthew brings Jesus up to the Jordan River. He steps into the Jordan River. He doesn't split the Jordan River. Anybody can do that. That's already been done 3 or 4 times in the Bible. That wouldn't make him special enough. So Matthew has him step into the Jordan River and split the heavens. Now that's something. What are the heavens? Read the creation story. The Jews thought the heavens were the firmament above which separated the waters above from the waters below. So Jesus splits the heavenly waters, and they flow down upon him in the form of spirit, because living water is always a synonym for the Holy Spirit in the Hebrew Scriptures. One has only to read Zechariah to see that case clearly made. And so the baptism of Jesus is told as a kind of magnified Red Sea story. Jesus has his Red Sea experience in the Jordan River at his baptism. Moses had his baptismal experience in the waters of the Red Sea. And then Matthew parallels them. The temptation story, when it's told in the Gospel of Mark, the first gospel, is one line. Jesus was in the wilderness 40 days being tempted by the devil. That's all he says. Matthew has that story in front of him, but he develops it. And he develops it so that Jesus has 3 great temptations, and he describes the content of them. Wonder where Matthew got those 3 temptations. We'll go back and read the Moses story. When Moses got through the Red Sea experience, the first thing he did was to wander in the wilderness for 40 years, trying to figure out what it means to be the people of God. So Matthew says that Jesus wandered around in the wilderness for 40 days, trying to figure out what it means to be the Messiah. And while Moses was in the wilderness, he had 3 critical experiences. The first one had to do with the shortage of food. That's when Moses prayed to God and heavenly bread came raining down from the sky to feed the starving Israelites. The second crisis was when there was a shortage of water. And Moses acted precipitously and put God to the test. Moses struck a rock at Meribah and demanded that God bring water out of the rock. And God did, because God didn't want to leave Moses with his face hanging out. But God was not pleased, because the Bible says again and again, the sin of Moses was that he put God to the test. And that's why Moses could not go into the promised land. The third critical moment for Moses, while he was in the wilderness, came when he was on top of Mount Sinai conferring with God. Moses did that rather frequently. And when he came back to his people, he found that they had turned away from God and had made golden calves, and they were worshiping these idols, and they were saying, "This is the God who brought us out of Egypt." Interesting crises in Moses' life. Well, look at what Matthew does to the temptations of Jesus. The first temptation, just like Moses, is about the shortage of food. "Turn these stones into bread, Jesus." The second temptation, just like Moses, is putting God to the test. "Cast yourself off the pinnacle of the temple, Jesus. He'll catch you." The third temptation, just like Moses, is worshiping something other than God. "Bow down before me, Jesus, and I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world." That's not coincidental. It's also not literal history. That's a Jewish writer interpreting the life of Jesus in terms of the symbols of the great hero of the Jewish past, whose name was Moses. Let me go back to Joseph for just a moment, because Matthew is the one who introduces Joseph. There's no Joseph in the first gospel. There's no Joseph in the writings of Paul. Matthew introduces Joseph. Wonder why he called him Joseph. Well, some people say he called him Joseph because that was his name. I'm suspicious of that. I think he called him Joseph because he wanted to communicate something about the Jewish tradition. The Jewish nation was divided into two groups. One group was the group that gathered around Jerusalem called Judah. And the other group was the group that gathered around what we call the Northern Kingdom. The ancestor of the tribe of Judah was the man Judah, one of the sons of Levi, and not Levi, one of the sons of Leah. But the patron saint and chief patriarch of the Northern Kingdom was Joseph, the son of Rachel. And if you go back and read that story in the Hebrew Scriptures, you'll find that Rachel and Leah were sisters and that Jacob loved Rachel and didn't really love Leah. Pretty tough on Leah. She's described in the Bible as having the eyes of a cow. She was a little pop-eyed lady, I suppose. And Laban, their father, married off Leah to Jacob under cover of darkness. He didn't know who he was being married to. And he didn't discover it until the daylight came the next day. And he complained because he had had to work 7 years for the right to marry Rachel, his beloved, and he got her older sister. And Laban says, oh, you just can't marry the younger sister if you don't first marry off the older sister. And that was no great problem because you could have multiple wives in those days. And so Jacob worked 7 more years, but he got Rachel in advance. So he had these 2 daughters. And Israel was divided into these 2 camps, the Joseph camps and the Judah camps. Messiah's got to bring them together. Jesus is portrayed as the son of David, so that comes through the Judah line. So that line is covered. When he makes the earthly father of Jesus a man named Joseph, he brings the character of the northern Jews into this figure. And then he begins to describe this Joseph. We learn 3 things about Joseph in Matthew 1 and 2. That's the only place there's any biographical data about Joseph. We learn that Joseph has a father named Jacob. We learn that Joseph is only communicated to by dreams. God never speaks to Joseph except in a dream. And 3, we learn that Joseph's role in the drama of salvation, as Matthew is telling it, is to save the children of promise from death, or the child of promise from death, by taking him down into Egypt. Now go back and read the story of Joseph the patriarch, Genesis 37 to 50. The Joseph of the coat of many colors. You'll discover that this Joseph, first of all, has a father named Jacob. You'll discover that this Joseph is identified over and over and over again with dreams. He's called a dreamer. He becomes an interpreter of dreams. He rides into political power in Egypt by his ability to interpret the Pharaoh's dream. And his role in the drama of salvation is to save the people of the covenant from death. And how is he going to save them? He's going to save them by taking them down to Egypt. Matthew is just simply relating the history of the Jewish people in this character that he has developed called Joseph that enters his story only after the virgin birth enters his story. Over and over again, Matthew is using the symbols of the Hebrew tradition and most particularly the symbol of Moses to tell his narrative. When Matthew brings Jesus out of the wilderness following the temptation, he moves immediately into the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew is the only gospel writer that tells us that Jesus ever preached a Sermon on the Mount. Matthew clearly constructed the Sermon on the Mount. It was his way of portraying Jesus as the new and greater Moses. Now, what you don't know, but what every Jew would have known, was that the Jews celebrated Moses receiving the law from God at Mount Sinai on a day they call Shavuot, or Pentecost, 50 days after Passover. They celebrated this with a 24-hour vigil. The people worshiped through a 24-hour period. They wrote a psalm for this 24-hour vigil. It's the longest psalm in the Psalter. It's Psalm 119. If you've got to have the psalm that goes through 24 hours, it's got to be a rather long psalm. It's 176 verses. Most people in church wouldn't read that psalm today. They'd read maybe two or three at most segments of it. The psalm is about a hymn of praise to the beauty and wonder of the law. But on Shavuot, they worship God in a 24-hour vigil to thank God for giving the law. And Psalm 119 was the psalm written for Shavuot. It opens with eight stanzas of introduction. Two of those eight stanzas begin with the word blessed, in Greek makarios. And then it has eight segments of three stanzas each, one for each of the 3 hours of a 24-hour liturgy. And that's exactly the form in which the Sermon on the Mount is created. 5, 6, and 7, Matthew has shaped the Sermon on the Mount as a Christian version of Psalm 119. It too has an introductory stanza of eight verses. Not just two of them, but all eight of them begin with the word blessed. We now call them the Beatitudes. And then he has eight sections of three segments each, in which he interprets the eight Beatitudes, and he does it in reverse order. Jesus never preached the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew created the Sermon on the Mount. It's part of his way of portraying Jesus as the new Moses. Constantly he's contrasting. Jesus says, "You heard it said of old, you shall not kill." That's Moses. That's commandment number 6. "But I say unto you, you cannot even hate, for that's where killing always begins." So Jesus takes the law of Moses and drives it internally. He's a new and greater Moses being portrayed by Matthew. You cannot understand Matthew's gospel without seeing Jesus being portrayed as the new and greater Moses. Now, when you get to Luke, you discover that Luke makes Elijah the factor around which he's going to interpret Jesus. The law looked inward. Luke didn't want to look inward. Luke wanted to look outward. Luke was born a Gentile, converted to Judaism. Luke constantly wants to universalize this message. Luke has a genealogy of Jesus, but Matthew's genealogy starts with Abraham, the father of the Jewish nation. Luke's genealogy starts with Adam, the father of humankind, because he wants the story to be broader. And the prophetic movement looks outward, not inward. So Elijah becomes his hero. And he wraps Elijah around Jesus as the way he interprets the life of Jesus. If you understand that that's what's going on, you'll discover that Luke is the first gospel writer to say that John the Baptist is not Elijah at all. He's going to save Elijah because he's going to use him for Jesus, not for a secondary figure like John the Baptist. So he says John the Baptist just comes in the spirit of Elijah, but he's not the new Elijah. It's interesting that when you get to Luke, you discover that there's only one healing story in the entire Old Testament. That's the healing of a foreigner, and it occurs in the Elijah-Elisha cycle of stories. His name is Naaman. He's a Syrian, and he has leprosy. And he's cured by being told to wash in the Jordan River. Only Luke, of all the gospel writers, has a story about people who are lepers that are cured by Jesus by washing in the Jordan River. And one of them is a foreigner, a Samaritan, and he returns to give thanks. Only Luke tells that story, because only Luke is concerned to portray Jesus as the new and greater Elijah. Only Luke tells the story of Jesus raising from the dead the only son of a widow in the village of Nain. If you go back to the Elijah-Elisha circle, you will find that Elijah raises the only son of a widow and restores him to his mother. And the details of those stories are identical. Wonder why, if something so dramatic as the raising of the dead really happened, Wonder why everybody didn't talk about it. Only Luke tells you the story, because it's an Elijah story, and he's building his drama so that Jesus is portrayed as the new and greater Elijah. And Luke reaches his climax of this when he tells the story of Jesus' ascension and the outpouring of the Holy Spirit. And if you don't know the Elijah story, you'll never understand what Luke is talking about. Elijah also ascends into heaven. Most of us are not that familiar with the Hebrew Scriptures. But Elijah needed a lot of help. Elijah had to have a magical fiery chariot drawn by magical fiery horses that came out of the sky and picked up Elijah and carried him heavenward. Now, even the ancients who didn't understand about gravity knew that you needed some sort of propulsion. So you get the magic horses drawing the magic chariot, but that's not quite enough. So God sends a whirlwind, comes propelling Elijah upward. And before this happens, there's been a sort of final deathbed conversation between Elijah and Elisha. And Elisha says, "Master, I know you're getting ready to go, and I know you've given me the responsibility of being the new prophet of Israel, but I cannot do it if you don't grant me one final request." "What is that, my son?" says Elijah. "Well, I need to be endowed with a double portion of your spirit." And Elijah says, "I don't know that I have that power to give it to you. But if you see me ascending into the heavens, then you will know that your request has been granted." And it was at that moment that the fiery chariot drawn by the fiery horses came and picked up Elijah. And the whirlwind propelled them heavenward, and Elisha saw. And Elisha knew he was going to be endowed with a double portion of Elijah's spirit. Now look at the Jesus story. Luke clearly had this Elijah narrative in mind. How do you demonstrate that Jesus is the new and greater Elijah? Well, Jesus walks with his disciples out to the rendezvous point where the separation is going to take place. This is Acts chapter 1, written by Luke, volume 2 of Luke's gospel. And they're talking about what they're going to do, who they're going to be in the kingdom. And then Jesus ascends into the sky with no help. No fiery horses, no chariots. He's so much greater than Elijah, he doesn't need that help. And as Jesus ascends into the sky, he tells the disciples that they are to wait until they are endowed with the Spirit. But it's not a double portion of Jesus' human spirit. That's all Elijah had to give. It's the infinite power of God's Holy Spirit, poured out not just on a single disciple, but on a whole community, and sufficient to last through all the ages. Luke took the story of Elijah and magnified it 100-fold, magnified it to the nth power, and retold it about Jesus of Nazareth. That's the way the Gospels came to be written. They're not literal stories. They're interpretive narratives, where Jewish stories of Jewish heroes in whom God was active and present are magnified to try to reach a big enough kind of conclusion to make sense out of the fact that Jesus was even greater than the God presence they had known in all of their deepest, holiest Jewish people, Jewish traditions. So you get Matthew wrapping the Moses story around Jesus. You get Luke wrapping the Elijah story around Jesus. What I want you to see is that the Gospels are interpretations of the life of Jesus. They're Jewish interpretations that the Jews would have recognized. The Gentiles who became ignorant of the Jewish past could only literalize them because they didn't know any other way to read them. The Gospels are not biography. They're not describing events that really happened. They aren't written for 40 to 70 years after Jesus' life is over. They don't know the events that really happened. They just have some traditions. And they organize these in such a way as to interpret the power that they've experienced. Now, that could only have happened in the synagogue. Why? Because that's the only place the Jewish scriptures were read. People didn't have Bibles. They're far too expensive. A Bible was a community property. It was something that only the synagogue had. The only place people ever heard the Bible being read was in synagogue. The only place they ever heard the Bible being interpreted was in the synagogue. The only place where the Bible was ever taught was in the synagogue. And the only place where the Jesus story could have been wrapped around the scriptures of the Hebrew people was in the synagogue. The oral period from 30 to 70 was where Jesus was remembered, took place in the synagogue. Sabbath after Sabbath after Sabbath. People don't recognize that the Christian church didn't separate from the synagogue until 88 of this common era, by which time certainly Mark and Matthew were already written. Luke may have been later than that, but Luke based his gospel on Mark. And so he's still in that synagogue period of time. And Western Christians did not realize this because they were Gentiles, because they were ignorant of the Hebrew traditions. They were ignorant of the Hebrew scriptures. They were prejudiced against all things Jewish. So the oral period had to have taken place in the synagogue, and that's where Jesus was remembered. Now, when you say that to most Christian congregations or audiences, they don't understand what you're talking about because they have no earthly idea what a synagogue worship service was like. And how can you try to envision the story of Jesus being orally transmitted in a synagogue if you don't know anything about synagogue worship? Well, the nice thing about that is that we have a little vignette in the book of Acts where Luke sort of tells us what happens in a synagogue. The 13th chapter, the 13th and following verses. Paul and his companions set out to sail from Paphos and came to Perga in Pamphylia. John, however, left them and returned to Jerusalem. But they went on from Perga and they came to Antioch in Pisidia. And on the Sabbath day, they went into the synagogue and they sat down. And this is the synagogue liturgy. After the reading of the law, that's the Torah. That's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. The first thing they did in the Jewish synagogue was to read the Torah. And they were required in the first century to read the entire Torah on the Sabbaths of a single year in public worship in the synagogue. That meant that the Torah lesson was between 5 and 6 chapters of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And they would always read it in order. You have to read it in order. Have you ever tried to read a scroll by skipping around? The books are not in pages, they're in scrolls. So they'd read to the place where they stopped for this Sabbath, and they'd put the scroll up, and the next Sabbath they would bring it out, and they'd pick up where they left off. They would start reading the Torah on the first Sabbath of the Jewish liturgical year, and they would complete the Torah at the end of the last Sabbath of the Jewish liturgical year. And that was the first lesson. Christians today wouldn't stand for a lesson that long. But see, the Jews couldn't do anything else on the Sabbath. They might as well stay in the synagogue and listen to the Bible being read. They were forbidden from doing anything else. So that's the first part of the liturgy. You read the Torah, the law. And then Luke says, they read the prophets. Well, you and I need to know there were two kinds of prophets. That's not one lesson, that's two lessons. They had what they called the earlier prophets. That would be Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. Not Chronicles, it's a very late development in Jewish scripture. This is a period of Israel's life after Moses. Sort of reflected in the book of Acts, it's a period of the Christian church's life after Jesus. This was the second lesson. They weren't very religious about the second lesson. They didn't have to finish it at any particular time, so they'd read a sort of reasonable portion. And then they read from the latter prophets. And who were the latter prophets? They were four. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and not Daniel. Daniel's a second century work. He didn't come along for a long time. The fourth one was what they call the Book of the Twelve, and what you and I call the Minor Prophets, Hosea through Malachi. And the interesting thing about these four books is they're all about the same size. You wonder why? That was the size of the scroll. They had a little blank space on the scroll. They just put another prophet. That's why we have 1st Isaiah, 2nd Isaiah, and 3rd Isaiah. We have no idea who wrote 2nd and 3rd. They were just attached to the work of the prophet Isaiah. We also have 1st and 2nd Zechariah. Had a little extra space at the end of that scroll, too. So they kept adding to their tradition. And they would read these four prophets on a four-year cycle. 1 year would be the Isaiah year, 1 year would be the Jeremiah year, 1 year would be the Ezekiel year, and the last year would be the year in which they read the 12. And then after they finished the reading of those three lessons, this is what the text says in Acts 13. After the reading of the law and the prophets, the officials of the synagogue sent them a message saying, "Brothers, if you have any word of exhortation for the people, give it." So Paul stood up and with a gesture began to speak. And he speaks for the balance of that chapter. And he goes through the history of the Israelites. And he relates Jesus to this event and that event and this event. It makes everything look forward to Jesus. That's the way the story of Jesus was remembered. Between the year 30 and the year 70, the silent years before anything was written, everything we know about Jesus filtered through 40 years of oral transmission in the synagogue, and everything we know about Jesus was celebrated and remembered in synagogue preaching against the lessons. That's why when the Gospels are written, the stories of the Hebrew Scriptures are wrapped deeply, significantly, around the life of Jesus of Nazareth. That's half of the liturgical background. The Jesus story was interpreted against the readings of the Hebrew Scriptures. But the Jews also had a liturgical year. You know, we didn't develop the liturgical year, we Christians. The Jews had one. We have Advent and Christmas and Epiphany and Lent and Easter and Ascension and Whitsuntide. But the Jews had special days in which they remembered the special events of their history. These were big moments, and they celebrated them every year. But we Christians know very little about them. But that liturgical year was also used to interpret the Jesus experience. I want to look at two of the major holidays, major holy days of the Jewish people, and show how they were used to interpret the Jesus experience. I want to look at how the Passover story shaped the crucifixion, and then how the Jewish day of Yom Kippur shaped the way the Christians interpreted the cross. First, Passover. Most Christians would say that Jesus was crucified at the time of the Passover. It's easy to say that because that's what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John say. But there's another way to look at that. Was the story of the cross placed into the Passover season? Not because it happened there, but because the Passover season was used to interpret the death of Jesus. Because Jesus came to be seen as the new Passover lamb. That's what Paul had said back in the 50s. Paul said, "Christ, our new Passover lamb, our paschal lamb, has been sacrificed for us." Now, every gospel says that the crucifixion took place at the time of the Passover. But if you read the stories carefully, you'll discover that it's not quite as convincing as once you thought. Let me tell you the story. Passover was celebrated by the Jews on the 14th and 15th day of the month of Nisan. That's a Jewish month, not a Japanese automobile. 14, 15, Nisan. In our calendars, in the Northern Hemisphere that would come in mid-March to late March. That would be in the spring of the year. The Gospels tell us that before the Palm Sunday, before the time of the crucifixion, that there was a procession into Jerusalem. We call it the Palm Sunday procession. If Nisan is 1415, I mean, if Passover is 1415 Nisan, the Palm Sunday procession would be even a week earlier. So you're back to the middle of March, toward the end of March. And then the Gospels tell us that in this Palm Sunday procession a week before the crucifixion, all the worshipers waved leafy branches. Well, that's interesting. There are no leaves in the Northern Hemisphere in the middle of March. So it presents a little bit of a problem. It looks like maybe there's a dislocation of time. It's also interesting to see what the Gospels do about that. Mark, who is the first one to say that Palm Sunday was a week before the crucifixion, and Mark says they wave leafy branches, but when Matthew comes to copy Mark, Matthew seems to know there's a problem. So the leaves disappear. In Matthew, they only wave branches. Well, that'd make a lot of sense because it's only the leaves that wave. You don't wave sticks. But Matthew looks like he's trying to address a problem that somebody's brought to his attention. When you get to Luke, who also has Mark in front of him, not only do the leaves disappear, but the branches disappear. Luke just leaves that out. Luke says all the worshipers do is to lay down their clothes in front of Jesus, which also might suggest that it was a warmer season than the middle of March. Again, remember, this is the Northern Hemisphere. You'd have to translate it into the October period of the year. So we have a hint, kind of a camel's nose under the tent, that maybe there's something wrong with the dating of the crucifixion at the time of the Passover. That's not the only hint, that's just where we begin. Then you read Mark's story. Mark says that Jesus comes into Jerusalem on the Palm Sunday procession, that he goes to the temple. He looks around, he sees all the money changers, he doesn't do a thing. He just goes back down to Bethany, which is about 2 miles away, where he and his disciples seem to be having their camp, probably at the home of Mary and Martha, who is the Bethany family that they seem to know best. And the next day, they're going to come into Jerusalem, and Mark says that's the day on which the temple is going to be cleansed of those money changers. But that's an interesting little story on the way. Jesus is hungry, says Mark, and he sees a fig tree in the distance. And he goes to the fig tree looking for figs. Folks, there are no figs on fig trees in March in the Northern Hemisphere. The fig tree doesn't come into fruit until September, October. Jesus goes to the fig tree looking for figs in March. That didn't make a lot of sense. And guess what? He doesn't find any. And Mark adds, it was not the season for figs. That didn't stop Jesus. He lays a curse on the fig tree. That doesn't sound very Jesus-like. There's some things that fig trees just can't do. There's some things that people can't do. I don't want to have a curse laid on me because I can't get pregnant. You know, there's just some things that are beyond the possibility, even of miracles. Well, a fig tree bearing figs in the early, late winter, early spring in the Northern Hemisphere just doesn't make sense. But Jesus lays a curse on it. And then they go up to Jerusalem. He cleanses the temple. And then they come back, and guess what? They find the fig tree, and it's shriveled all the way down to the roots. And Peter says, Lord, your curse took. Look at that dead fig tree. And Jesus responds with words that don't make a bit of sense in that context. Like saying, you just got to have faith, Peter. Doesn't make a lot of sense. Now let's look at what the other gospel writers do to that. Matthew comes along, he sees this story, and he can't make sense out of that. But doesn't know quite what to do with it, but at least he collapses it so he doesn't have to deal with it but once. In Mark, you curse the fig tree, then go cleanse the temple, and you come back and find the fig tree shriveled, and then you have the conversation about it. Matthew says, no, he cursed the fig tree and it shriveled immediately. So he got it out of the way, didn't have to come back to it. And when you get to Luke, guess what Luke does? He leaves it out. If it appears at all in Luke's gospel, it appears as the parable of the fig tree that didn't bear fruit and they wanted to cut it down. And they said, oh no, let's try to work with it for a year or so. But it's not an episode in the life of Jesus. The gospel writers seem to want to clear out the things that don't quite fit. Now, if this was the fall of the year, the time for figs, it might make a little more sense, because a fig tree is not much good if it doesn't produce figs. A temple in Jerusalem is not much good if it doesn't produce holiness. Maybe that was the original connection. But it looks like a fall episode has been dragged into the spring, just like the leaves or the clothes. There's one other thing, again, that Christians don't know anything about because we're not that familiar with Jewish activity. The Jews had a celebration in the fall of the year, middle to the end of October. That was their harvest festival. They called it Sukkot, spelled S-U-K-K-O-T-H, but pronounced like a woman's name, Sue, and a woman's garment, a coat, Sukkot. If your tongue isn't made in Jerusalem, you might never pronounce that correctly. I hear people call it Sukkoth and Sukkot and all sorts of strange things, but it was Sukkot. It was a harvest festival. And guess how the Jews celebrated it? This is late October, Northern Hemisphere. Keep that in mind. The Jews celebrated it by making something they called a lulav. That was a group of leafy branches. They would bind them together. They were made of willow, myrtle, and palm. They'd be roped together, and the worshippers carried a lulav in their right hand, and they waved it as they walked in procession. And in the celebration of Sukkot, as they waved these lulav branches in procession and in the temple, they recited the Psalm of Sukkot, which is Psalm 118, which just happens to say, Hosanna in the highest, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now, people walking in procession, waving branches, leafy branches, and saying, Hosanna in the highest, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, ought to sound familiar to traditional Christians. All of those symbols are in the Jewish fall season of Sukkot, but they've been pushed into the Passover in the early spring of the year. Why? Not because Jesus was crucified at the time of the Passover, but because the Passover was used to interpret the death of Jesus, and that was very important. The first time the Last Supper comes into the Christian tradition is in 1 Corinthians 11. Paul does not identify it with the Passover meal at all. But when the Last Supper appears in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's identified with the Passover meal. It's not in John, but the Passover is still the background of the story. Paul had identified Jesus with the Passover lamb. How is Jesus the new Passover lamb? Well, if you don't know the old Passover lamb story, you can hardly make sense out of that image. So you almost have to go back and tell that story. This was the Exodus moment. God was sending the final plague upon the Egyptians. God's angel of death was going to go through the land and murder, kill the firstborn male in every Egyptian household. And the Jewish people were warned to take a lamb from their flocks and to slaughter the lamb, and to put the blood of the lamb on their doorpost. And when the angel of death came along and saw blood on the doorpost, the angel would pass over that house and only kill those where there wasn't blood on the doorpost, only kill Egyptians. So the blood of the lamb was interpreted to have magic power to banish the power of death. Now, how is the crucifixion story going to be told against that? Because they believed heaven was just above the sky, the cross becomes a doorpost to the world. It's suspended between heaven and earth. The new paschal lamb on the new doorpost sheds his blood. And that means he breaks the power of death. And that means those who want to come to God through the blood of the sacrificial lamb of Passover are able to banish the power of death just as Jesus banished the power of death. It's an interpretive story. My bet is it was a sermon preached by an early Christian preacher at the time of Passover in order to make Jesus' life be interpreted against the Passover lamb. Well, once you've got Jesus identified with one lamb, it's easy to identify him with another. So the Jews had another day. On the 10th day of the month of Tishri, which would also be in early October, and they called it Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And the Jews observed this day in a rather unusual way. It was the day the Jews were taught to remember that they were created to be in a perfect relationship with God. And they recalled this perfection once a year. They never wanted to forget what their destiny was. But they had this sense of living separated from God. And so liturgically, once a year, they found a way they could come into atonement, into oneness with God. They celebrated Yom Kippur. It was a 24-hour day. They celebrated it with two animals. One tended to be a lamb. One tended to be a goat. They had to be perfect. They had to be male because they valued males above females. They had to be without blemish, spot, or broken bone. They had to be healthy. And the high priest had to certify them this way. And they brought the lamb first to the high priest, and he examined it. And when the priest finished, pronounced the lamb perfect, the lamb was slaughtered. And the high priest would take the blood from the slaughtered lamb and go into the temple, past the holy place where Jews could go, into the Holy of Holies where only the priest could go, and he only once a year, and he only after elaborate cleansing. And he would take the blood of this sacrificed lamb and smear it all over the mercy seat where God was supposed to sit. And then the people would say, the only way we can come to God is through the blood of the lamb. Does that sound familiar? And then he would come out from the Holy of Holies, and the people would be gathered in the holy place, and he would take the blood of the lamb and he would sprinkle it on the worshipers so they could say they had been washed in the blood of the lamb. Again, another phrase that's come deep into our Christian tradition with no knowledge of where it comes from. The people who felt themselves imperfect were covered with the blood of the perfect Lamb of God. And that was supposed to have made them acceptable to God, despite their sinfulness. And then when that part of the liturgy was complete, they brought the goat. The goat met the high priest in the center of the synagogue or the temple. The high priest would take the horns of this goat, and bowing over the goat, the high priest would confess the sins of the people. And all the sins of all the people were thought to come out of the people and land on the head and back of the goat. And the goat became the sin bearer. And now the goat had all the sins. All the people were purged and purified. And the goat had all the sins on his back, on his head. The people were encouraged to pronounce curses upon the goat because the goat was so evil. Call for the goat's death because somebody with that much evil did not deserve to live. But they didn't kill the goat. They rather opened a space in the assembly of the people, and they drove the goat carrying all the sins of the people out into the wilderness. The goat became the sin bearer. When you and I in our liturgies on Sunday morning in our respective churches say, O Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, we don't have any idea that we're quoting the liturgy of Yom Kippur. We've turned it into a kind of literal story of the life of Jesus. And before the Gospels were written, those images were wrapped around Jesus. Remember the story of Jesus not having any broken bones? That's so he could be the symbolic lamb of Yom Kippur, physically perfect, young, male, without spot, blemish, or broken bone. Remember the story in the Passion where the crowd hollers, crucify him, every Jew would have recognized that that's what you do to one who is the designated sin bearer. You call for his death. Jesus was being interpreted under the symbol of the scapegoat, as he was called. There's one other symbol. Remember Barabbas? Remember Pilate tried to free Barabbas instead of Jesus? Remember that the story said that once a year Pilate had a custom of freeing a prisoner, and he had a notorious prisoner named Barabbas? Well, I've searched Jewish records, I've searched Roman records. I can find no tradition where Pilate freed a prisoner at Passover. It seems to be a tradition that happened only once. And some churches, once is enough to create a long-standing tradition. But this does not appear to be a tradition. It appears to be a story told as part of the crucifixion. So I became suspicious of Barabbas' historicity. And then I looked at his name. And though I don't speak a lot of Hebrew, I know enough to know what that name means. The Hebrews had two words for son. One was bar and one was ben. Bar means son. Abba means God. Barabbas means son of God. There were two sons of God, say the gospel writers. One was slaughtered and one was set free. There were two animals at Yom Kippur. One was slaughtered, the other was set free. The story of Jesus is far more a narrative to interpret him against the Jewish background than people understand. These stories are written into the Gospels out of their Jewish liturgical and Jewish scriptural background. The Gospel writers were interpreters of Jesus, not biographers. They interpreted Jesus through the Hebrew scriptures. They interpreted Jesus through the Hebrew liturgies. But what was the experience that they were trying to interpret? What was the Jesus experience? What made people think that it was appropriate to interpret Jesus through Hebrew scriptures, through Hebrew liturgical experiences? What made them think it was appropriate to say he was born of a virgin? What made them think it was appropriate to say that he dispensed miracles, nature miracles, raising of the dead miracles, healing miracles? What made them think it was proper to say of Jesus that at the end of his life he simply rose up into the sky to return to God? What was the experience people had with Jesus of Nazareth that caused them to interpret him so dramatically within the Jewish context? There must have been something about this Jesus that made that seem an appropriate thing to do. And I submit that that's where the heart of the Christian gospel lives. What was there about Jesus of Nazareth that convinced them that the Holy God had been met in him? And that will be my theme for tomorrow afternoon. Thank you for your time and attention.